Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. This week, the Vera Rubin Observatory just started taking its first data and sending out its first alerts to astrophysicists around the world. Rubin is now taking regular, deep, and high-resolution photographs of the night sky, producing some of the biggest astrophysical datasets ever generated by humanity. For example, in the first night of Rubin alerts, we discovered 42 new supernovae, just in the first night. The survey is being called the Legacy Survey of Space and Time, or LSST. Actually, that acronym was repurposed from the previous name of the observatory, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. We've talked about the LSST survey a number of times on this podcast. One of my earliest guests, Dr. Ashley Villar, talked about how the upcoming data being generated is so vast that we will need to use machine learning algorithms, or what many people like to call AI, to comb through it all. A number of my guests have listed the Rubin Observatory as the new telescope they were the most excited about, even when compared with JWST. So what is so special about Rubin? What makes it so different from every other telescope we built in Chile, and how much work did it take us to get us to this moment? To answer these questions, today, for the first time, my guest is an instrumentalist, that is, an astronomer whose primary research involves the technological development of the telescope itself. We will be talking with Dr. Daniel Pullen, who helped with the development and construction of the camera inside the Rubin Observatory that gets us these incredible images that the rest of the world gets to enjoy. Let's find out just how much work it takes to build the biggest digital camera in the world. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast.
I will end up asking you about LSST and Rubin.
People only want to talk about LSST.
Well, I will ask you about that. Yeah. I'm asking you about your research, so probably that is likely to have to do with that.
Likely. I also look for dark photons.
All right, and then we can talk about that too. I don't know anything about that, so it'll be a good chance to do that. Is there anything else we should mention? I interrupt a lot.
Sorry. Are we recording now?
Well, we are technically recording now, but I definitely won't.
Probably don't want to put the...
Whatever, we're recording, but probably this won't get used. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, good. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I am Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Daniel Pullen, who this past year got his PhD from the UC Davis and is one of the people who's helped construct the camera that is now at the Vera Rubin Observatory. Dr. Pullen, thank you for joining me on my little podcast.
Happy to be here, Paul.
Thank you. I'm going to start out by doing this because the first episode was Abigail Pullen. I pretended not to know her. And then, I felt dumb about that later on. And then I did another episode later where we actually said where we knew each other from. So I'm not going to... I will just say... that you're my brother-in-law, and you're Abigail Pullen's brother, and you also happen to be in astrophysics, and
family business.
Yeah. So, I'd start out by saying how did we first meet each other, but that would be. That would be from Abigail bringing me home to visit your parents and that sort of thing. But let me then refresh. I mean, I know we already did this with Abigail, but we might as well do this with you. Is to just maybe you'll get a different perspective on it. But the first part of this is to ask how you got into science and how you grew up and that sort of thing. So let me start by asking, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on a small hobby farm.
Mm-hmm.
What has Abigail covered?
Well, if you say exactly the same thing, it's fine. That's what she said, is she grew up on a farm in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So what was that like for you growing up in rural Lancaster, Pennsylvania?
Well, I enjoyed it. I don't really know an alternative option.
Okay.
We raised goats. We raised chickens. Mm-hmm. I always liked that. I thought it was a good childhood because we had a big patch of land we could roam around on. There was a creek you could go play in.
So you had a lot of freedom.
Lots of animals to take care of.
And lots of animals. Do you have a favorite animal?
A favorite animal. I mean, the ones that live inside tend to be your favorite, I think.
Okay. I meant animals that you raise on the farm.
Yeah, I like the goats.
Yeah.
I had a pet goat named Delia. I had a pet pig. That was she was a little bit bigger than the goats.
I want to try to get a sense of how you went from that into getting to how you got into science. First, let me ask you this. Do you have a memory of the first time you thought you'd be interested in science or some memory of like...
I have a lot of memories that are retrospectively about science that I didn't really understand at the time. So, for one thing, in the winter, in the summer, you can water the chickens with a hose.
Okay.
In the winter, you can't do that because the hose freezes up, and you can't have an automatic water that runs all the way down to a chicken coop. So you have to take a bucket.
Okay.
And, you know, this is going to be a different story than Abigail because she never actually did any of the work.
Okay.
So you fill the bucket, and then you have to carry the bucket all the way down to the chicken coop.
Okay.
And I was about as tall as the bucket, you know, like those general buckets you get at the big box stores, Lowe's or Home Depot, 5-gallon buckets. So my methodology would be to spin, because spinning would create lift. Uh-huh. And if you spin all the way down to the chicken coop, you can have the bucket almost at not quite a 90-degree angle, but at least 45, and the water doesn't spill out of that. So
tiny Daniel Poland, it's like you're the size of the bucket, basically.
Yeah.
And you're spinning. You got the full of water.
Mm-hmm.
And you're spinning.
Most of it gets to the chicken coop.
That's good to hear. That's actually very impressive.
I've always liked problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the reason I got into science. I've always liked problem solving, and I've always liked building things.
Mm-hmm.
And so farm actually gives you a surprising amount of leeway to do that.
Sure.
So you can find like that is a physical solution to a problem.
Yes.
Or how do you make a chicken waterer? How does that work?
Right.
How do you make a chicken waterer that you never have to water again? Like you can just attach a hose to it and it has a weight sensor or something.
Right.
So then, you know, you do that and then eventually you get into circuitry and things. There's all sorts of things that a farm gives you the ability to learn science.
Okay. And so that's sort of like how you think of, like, you know, when you look back, you think about
obviously when I was like a 5-year-old or whatever it was, I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to use a centripetal acceleration to keep the water in the bucket.
No. But it was still problem solving.
It's problem solving. And then when you learn those things in school, you do make those connections and you think of, oh, this is how the world works.
Yeah. So do you, would you say your parents encourage you in doing science?
Or yes.
They big influences?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it is they encouraged Abigail and my older siblings to do science.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they were definitely encouraging to do science. There was a program at what was called the North Museum, a local science museum, it's called Science Explorers that we did, where you go in and they'll teach you about science. You'll make things like Ooplek. This is a summer sort of camp thing.
Right, right.
You make little robots.
Yeah.
So that sort of thing. They definitely supported science.
Mm-hmm. And so, then how did you make this sort of, when did you first decide you were interested in astronomy and astrophysics and that type of stuff?
Did I decide I
did
was
you decide, interested? Or you're just interested in building things?
I was interested in building things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so in undergrad, I worked in high energy physics. I worked with the Atlas experiment,
mm-hmm.
or making or testing sensors and things with a professor at NYU named Alan Mincer.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some computational density functional theory, which I did not enjoy as much. because that is neither building thing. It is
when
solving problems. That was during an REU in undergrad.
Okay, so it was an undergrad research project somewhere.
Yeah, so I've had multiple experiences with that. But then, you know, when you're an undergrad looking for places to apply, you have to kind of decide field. And, you know, if you want to email professors or things, that's a good way to get in.
Right.
So I looked at what are the big unsolved problems, what are the big... cool up and coming things. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you look at the things that had happened recently, we had discovered, you know, LIGO had, when I was in high school, discovered gravitational waves. Was that high school or college? I don't remember.
I remember it was in, it long was time in ago. 2015.
I would have been in college for that.
Okay.
When was LHC?
That would have been when you were in high school.
So I got the order backwards.
Okay.
Yeah. So high school, they discovered the Higgs boson. College, they discovered gravitational waves. So you look at, what are the other things? It's, well, the unsolved problems, the biggest ones, you know, there's unification of gravity. I'm not going to do that. there's searching for dark matter, which, you know, you can try. That'd mm-hmm. be fun. Mm-hmm. And there's dark energy and those sorts of things. And so I look at what are the different things that do that sort of experiment. And you get all sorts of experiments that are looking for those. And then there are also big up-and-coming observatories, which might find something in space.
Right.
So there was JWST was an upcoming one. So I think I applied for some things with that. And I applied for to work with Professor Tony Tyson, mm-hmm. who is the chief scientist of the LSST. And he's at UC Davis. And he responded back that he liked that I said... I could solder on my application. So, you don't get that many instrumentalists who are applying for Astro, is what he told me.
I see.
I ended up getting that position.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's how I ended up in Astro, is because, you know, you look at all the cool projects and you email a few professors and one of them says, I like the cut of your jib, and and then you make the LSST.
Well, that's great. So you really weren't necessarily, I mean, it wasn't specifically astrophysics, other than at the time, maybe those were the big questions that you...
Those are the questions I was interested in, and those were the projects I was interested in, yeah.
Right. And what do you say, because you mentioned things like I guess there's dark matter and dark energy and things like that, and just generally, any big new survey is a lot of, like, at least half of the idea is we're going to discover things we didn't expect. And to just kind of keep an open mind, because we almost always do. What was there something that drew you specifically to those things, or did you just not see any big exciting discoveries to be made in other fields of physics?
Well, the LSST, when it was called the LSST, Rubin was originally pitched as the Dark Matter Telescope, way back in the 90s.
Yes.
So the idea was that they were looking for. The large-scale structure of dark matter, using gravitational lensing around and micro lensing around different galaxies and stuff. But in order to do that, you need to map the whole sky, and you need to map it to levels we haven't ever done before. So you need a really big telescope, and you need a really big field of view, basically.
So let me, we can get more into the science later, but I may as well, since you bring it up, let's dig into it a little bit. Is what you said, you talked about gravitational lensing, and you said it's a way of looking for dark matter, and that you have to look at a bunch of the sky. So let's maybe try to unpack that. First, let's explain what gravitational lensing is.
Gravity warps space-time, and light travels along what would be straight lines, but on a curved surface.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a massive object and light is going around it at an angle, it can get redirected. And so you get different looking objects than you would otherwise. So light looks warped or curved. Right.
So this is the same thing that Eddington discovered or was able to show to show that light, that starlight was bent around the sun, deflected slightly as the starlight passed around the sun, just basically due to the sun's gravitational field. So it's the same idea, but now we're not just looking at the sun and a little bit of a deflection of a starlight, but you're looking at galaxies and galaxy clusters, and so these very massive systems, and seeing how light is sort of bent around them. Is that the idea?
Yeah. So there's obviously different scales on which that can happen. Mm-hmm. The ones that make nice pictures are the strong gravitational lensing. Mm-hmm. So you get things like galaxies that have like a C shape, mm-hmm. or Einstein rings or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So that's when you have like maybe a really dense galaxy or something like that, and then something right behind it that that its light gets bent around, and so it distorts the image a lot, and then you get these kind of neat images that look, I mean, they're basically like a lensing thing, but it's using gravity as the lens.
Right.
Yeah.
So then there's microlensing, which is, mm-hmm. you're probably not going to see it as easily, but you can basically compute what the objects should look like and then what they do look like. Mm-hmm. And from that difference, you can map out how much mass is in between. Mm-hmm. And so because dark matter makes up the majority of the mass in the universe, we can make a map of where all the mass is, and then we can see where all the matter we can see is, and we can make, using that, we can make a map of where all of the dark matter is.
Okay, so that's a good, that's how it connects to dark matter, is the idea that most of the mass is in dark matter, but we can't see the dark matter directly. So this is a way of seeing it indirectly, of basically seeing the light get deflected and bent, distorted as it passes by the dark matter. I think that covered all the things that you said in that sentence. Why were we talking about that? Is because we were saying about big questions, and that this was the thing that LSST, that's originally idea.
That was the original idea. I mean, obviously, there are other reasons why the LSST is mm-hmm. Interesting, and there are other reasons why the government gave us money to build it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that was the original idea, and it grew from there. So when you're applying to grad schools, you look at that sort of thing, and that's why I applied to work with them.
And so do you feel like, what my question was do you feel like the questions in astrophysics were more interesting to you? That, like, when you were looking up what are the big questions, the big unsolved sort of physics questions?
Yeah, I would say the questions were more interesting, and the up-and-coming objects to build were more interesting.
Right.
So obviously, like, CERN, they did the thing they were trying to do.
And, right.
You know, they're always building more stuff, but...
Right. But the LHC, yeah. That's a good point, because when like you said, they discovered the Higgs boson when you were in high school.
Right.
And so that was basically, I mean, and not to say that there's not more you can do with the Large Hadron Collider, but it's less exciting when
it's less exciting to an undergraduate looking at what do I want to do? Although I worked for Atlas in undergrad, but mm-hmm. that was basically just in a lab, making sure amplifiers work the way they should.
Right.
Calibrating them.
But you were, I mean, that's the thing. It's interesting to me because you still were interested in working on these big projects that were trying to do an interesting science goal, but you it seems to me the way you're describing it, what you're interested in doing you just want to do fun problem solving and, you know, build things. And so it's not you may have been just as happy building things for an instrument that didn't end up detecting anything.
I have plenty of projects that haven't detected anything.
We can talk about those if you want. Let me first ask you, so you've gone through the process of getting a PhD. In a lot of ways, the process to getting a PhD is the process of kind of learning how to be a scientist and what is involved in actually doing science. So is there something you think that, I guess, how would you define that? What does it mean to be a scientist? What does it mean to do... What are the skills that you really that really help you become a better scientist?
What are the skills that help you be a better scientist? A lot of them are just problem solving, general ways of thinking and that thing.
But the sort of thing. I guess here, let me define the question a little better. Because sure. For example, the difference between, when you're in school, there's a lot of ways you can test your problem solving, right? There's a lot of, there's homework assignments and stuff, and some of them, depending on if it's a good course, you'll have lots of great problems to solve that are interesting.
Sure.
But that's not the same thing as being a scientist,
absolutely,
obviously.
Not. Yeah. So I don't know that I can sum it up in one idea, mm-hmm. but I would say some of the big things that people don't understand about being a scientist are things like being an experimentalist is things like systematic error.
Mm-hmm.
I think would be one of the big concepts. So 90% of my job is troubleshooting, mm-hmm. and figuring out why your experiment doesn't work,
right?
But the big thing that they don't teach you in undergrad as well as they should, I think, is what systematic error is and how to address it in your experiments.
Right.
So basically.
So maybe give a basic breakdown of that.
So
of like, what do you like? Let's first say define it. Like, what do you mean?
Define
by
what systematic error is. So there are different ways your experiments can go wrong. You could not have enough data or something, and that mm-hmm. gives you a type of error, which mm-hmm. is just you're not measuring it good enough.
Mm-hmm.
But also, your experiment could just be flawed in some way.
Right.
So you get an answer, and it might be a very precise answer, even. And it could be wrong, and you don't know. You have to have a methodology to do experiments on your experiment
mm-hmm.
to figure out how wrong could my experiment be. And I think that's something, when you're teaching physics, that is very hard to convey to something right. Someone like an undergraduate.
Right, because it's a much more deeper issue. You're not asking about if I introduce this thing, what error does it cause, or you're saying, generally speaking, how well I don't know everything. Could there be something that is going on that is causing errors, and how can I demonstrate that it's not?
Right.
How confident am I that the errors are smaller than this amount?
Well, and what checks have you done?
Right.
And like, if my machine was off in this way by this much, how off would that make it?
Right. And how would you know? And how would there be? Yeah. What tests can you do to find out how? Yeah. That's right.
Right.
I see. And so this is different from what we normally... So first of all, like when I would teach lab courses, the word error is one of the most commonly misunderstood concepts when teaching undergrad students in lab courses. Usually... when you're teaching students in a lab course, they hear the word error and they think it means like something that I did wrong or something that like some mistake that was made in the process. But the whole point is you can do everything right, but there will always no matter what, there's always some error. There's never perfect precision on anything you do. And so even just that concept is often misunderstood, just generally the concept of error. But like you were saying, there's multiple types of error. There's error that is more controlled, that you understand that from like, okay, if I've done the measurement if I've taken this much data, I'll have this much noise, I'll have this much signal, I can say this is how strong my signal is and this is how big my error bars will be. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about something that's much deeper, which is your experiment. There are just maybe things outside of your control that you don't know anything about that can be biasing your results or giving your results the wrong answer for one reason or another. And that's always, of course, there's no way of saying you've never done that. There's no way of saying you've figured out everything and know that there's nothing wrong with this experiment. But, like you were saying, the idea is basically just coming up with lots of tests or, you know, road testing it in every way you can. So what does that mean for, like, the type of experiments you do?
For the type of experiments I do.
So what's an example of that? Is it too hard to
describe? It kind of gets complicated when you get to things like the LSST, but I could give you an example from a lab course that I designed.
Okay.
So one lab experiment that I helped build was a rooftop cosmic microwave background detector.
Oh, okay.
And so basically it's an antenna, and we got a receiver that's supposed to pick up from, I think it's a Irish television satellite station, but it picks up in the range of the CMB.
Okay, microwave.
And in the microwave. it's not as quite the right frequency, but mm-hmm. it's good enough. And so basically they can calculate just based on the pickup, looking at the sky at different angles, how much microwave radiation they're picking up.
Mm-hmm.
And if they extrapolate that as a 1/cosine law, because the Earth is flat, and that's how much air is between us and space,
okay,
then they can figure out how much is not coming from the atmosphere. So what's that little remainder?
Okay, there's some piece that you can understand is being due to the atmosphere, and that because right. you're looking at it in different directions, you can remove that part
of it. You can remove that part of it and see what the intercept is mm-hmm. on the temperature axis. And basically you get a non-zero answer. And this is how they originally found the CMB too.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Penzias and Wilson did this, they thought they made a mistake. Right, they weren't looking for the cosmic microwave background, obviously.
Right.
They were just trying to do an experiment on their experiment to try and get rid of however much that background would be to figure out what their floor was, I think is what it was. And so they actually had to go and do a bunch of experiments on their experiments. They could say, oh, this is just an error, but they did things
right.
like they scrubbed out their antenna because they thought it might be bird poop.
Mm-hmm.
that they were picking up, and they tested over and over again and ran, you know, you have to run tests on how wrong could your experiment be, and determined that it was something they were picking up from space.
Right. And so nowadays we know that to be sort of what we just, you know, commonly describe as sort of leftover radiation from the Big Bang. But
it'd be really easy to just sweep that under the rug, right?
Right. You say, well, there's this extra noise source.
There was another group that a few years earlier picked up the same thing, and they have their notes from it. And
yeah,
that's a Nobel Prize that they didn't get because they didn't run any, they didn't see. Why are we off by that much?
Right.
And are we actually off by that much?
They just said, well,
that's an error. You know, chalk that up to systematics.
Okay, so that's a good example of where you might say it's systematic, you might think it's systematic error, but it's actually, or maybe it is, it's something you had never even imagined. I guess it depends on how you look at it. Is that what you're saying?
Once you do the experiment and figure out you have a systematic error, it's not an error anymore.
Okay.
So they were actually picking something up.
Right, right. So then you can actually, once you know that there is this persistent source, you can say there is this, that's a result. You can say there now this exists.
Your measurement's off by that much, yeah.
Right.
So that's a background, right?
Right. Right, so, right, right. Okay. And that's the cosmic microwave background.
Cosmic microwave background.
So that's a great example. It's interesting though, because we don't think of that. We don't think of that as a systematic error. We think of it as an interesting phenomenon. But
it was a systematic error until it wasn't.
Right, right, right.
For that other group that didn't get the Nobel Prize, it was a systematic error.
Right. And so I guess that's a good example of where you you know, the sort of thing you learn on the way to becoming a scientist is understanding how powerful that idea is and how much that, you know, how much that makes a difference. It's not just about building a great telescope or that sort of thing. It's about knowing how to interpret your results. So let me ask you this. What sort of things, you know, what sort of things do you like about doing science? Like what, or like about the job that you have doing science?
Well, I haven't had very many other jobs, so.
Okay.
I would say, I'm someone who actually likes the day-to-day, even. Mm-hmm. So I do like going in and having the daily problem. That's the troubleshoot. What's wrong with my machine?
Right.
How can I program this machine to talk to the other machine to actually do the thing I want it to?
Yeah. I find it's interesting because I find that's what most people find the biggest, hardest thing when they get into science.
Well, obviously, everybody likes the big thing of, I got this result, and it's like, it's a cool result.
Right.
I took this picture of the Trifid Nebula, and it looks nice.
Right.
There's a lot of work that goes behind that, and if you want to be a scientist, I think you either need to enjoy the minutiae, or you have to figure out that the minutia is worth doing, and I think I'm fortunate to be in the former category. So
yeah, I think what I find is you have to like the minutia enough to be like, you have to decide, you know, what sort of day-to-day work you can either enjoy or tolerate enough. Like,
right.
There will be some day-to-days, like you were saying with this density functional theory or whatever.
Sure.
You were like, I'm not going to enjoy the day-to-day of that.
Yeah, basically your job. Yeah. I wouldn't enjoy the day-to-day of that.
Why doesn't my code compile?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, there's a colon. I mean, you're still going to have that, right? I do enjoy programming to an extent. There's a lot of programming in instrumentation, obviously.
Right.
But I wouldn't want to be someone who simulates things for a living.
Right. So you like the day-to-day of like actually just troubleshooting and building and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so what is there anything you don't like about?
Well, I think anyone is going to have parts of their job they don't like.
Yeah.
Being a grad student is nice because the advisor takes care of most of the paperwork, I think is a way to put it.
Oh, yeah.
And there's going to be things in your project that you don't want to do on a given day. I like to have around 3 projects, I think, is optimal, so that there's always something that you can procrastinate doing by doing a different thing.
Yes.
That's good. If you get more than 3, then you're wasting time. And if you have less than 3, then you get bored doing the thing you're doing. Finding another job is annoying.
That's true.
I don't like that aspect.
That's true.
There are things about academia I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of competition where there doesn't need to be, and there's a lot of lack of, well, not really competition, but oversight when there should be.
Yeah.
I think is a way to put it.
The lack of oversight doesn't bug me as much as the unnecessary competition, because we just do that to ourselves.
It's
like totally
not
unnecessarily.
Yeah.
We just completely make each other's lives miserable.
Right.
for no reason.
You're all supposed to be on the same team.
Right.
Yeah.
All we're doing is looking at things in space and figuring them out. Like, why would we be competitive about that? There's no reason for that. But somehow we find a way. Yeah, that's true. but not everybody's super competitive, but there's enough people that are that make it a little bit frustrating.
Yeah.
So, and I guess what would you say are the biggest challenges in, you know, going from getting, you know, going from college to going to grad school to getting your PhD? Like, what is the sort of the biggest challenges you can think of?
I think it varies wildly based on where you go and who your advisor is.
Right.
I think applying to any job, be it grad school or whatever, is for most people a numbers game.
Yes.
You have to apply to a lot of schools.
Yeah. More so now even than ever, really.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's extremely competitive. I think being in grad school, a lot of people go into grad school thinking the wrong thing. I think they think they're going in it to take classes and like...
Right, because it's called school.
It's called school. you take classes, you pass tests.
Right.
And after like, I don't know, like your second year-ish, you're not taking class, you're doing research. You're being in grad school to be a scientist and to show that you can be a scientist.
Right.
Publish a few papers, find a few novel things, write a thesis, and leave. What was the question?
Oh, I guess what was the challenges in that?
So I think it's extremely advisor dependent. You know, there are people who don't have a good fit with their advisor, and I've seen that happen a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was very fortunate with Tony to be a pretty good fit, where our views towards science are similar and mm-hmm. the expectations are reasonable.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, because as a PhD advisor myself now, the biggest thing is being really clear about what I expect of my students, and being able to like, you know, make sure that like I'm not just being like, oh, just figure something out, you know. I like really
some people do great with just figure something out, and some people do not. So I think that there are definitely bad advisors, but there are much more just poor fit advisors,
right,
where it doesn't work out.
Right. That makes sense. So now I want to actually talk about science. Who knew you would talk about science on the Astrophysics Podcast? So here's the question I use to start the science portion, which is, first I clear my throat. Then I say, when you meet a new grad student or fellow scientist and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
Scientist. Oh, I for scientists, I tell them I work on the Rubin Observatory and the LSST camera.
Okay.
Because people generally know what the LSST is.
So that's the quick shorthand answer, is you just work on Rubin and
on the camera.
On the camera. Yeah. Okay.
For non-scientists, I tell them I build telescopes.
Okay.
And that's less intimidating than I'm a physicist.
So what you say you work on the camera. What does it mean? What do you mean? What camera?
So the Rubin Observatory has a big camera. It is the largest digital camera ever built.
It's the largest ever built. Now, I've heard that before. When you say largest, you mean physical size, or you mean...
Oh, I don't know about physical size. It's a couple tons.
It's definitely up there in the size.
It's a minivan sized. largest in terms of pixels. So it is 3.2 gigapixels.
Okay.
So several iPhones.
Okay. So...
At least several iPhones. Big.
How many? Yeah. So how many pixels is on an iPhone?
Do
you know that?
I think that the new ones are something like 45 megapixels. So, okay. You know, there's a good number.
Okay. So it's like still. So some thousands of iPhones or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah.
But it's a lot of pixels, and so many that I remembered in the. When they did the Rubin launch, they were showing off the idea, like, basically it's so many pixels that it's pointless to try to, like, you can't display them all at once, and actually with your own eyeballs you can't see the whole thing, all the data
at once. They use some unit like a number of 4K televisions you need to display it.
right. It's like feels like when people measure things in football fields or things like that.
The important thing in astronomy is that when you're pointing a camera at the sky, you want a given point source to be spread out of across a few pixels, basically.
Okay, so what do you mean by that? A point source needs to be spread across a few pixels. So, like, what do you mean by a point source?
So,
like,
if you have, say, a star or something, mm-hmm. that's going to have, through the atmosphere, through your telescope, something called a point spread function, which is basically just the shape it makes.
How large of an image that star or whatever object it is makes.
Generally what shape it is, but yeah, it should be circular roughly, and it if your optics are good, and it how spread out it is on your sensor.
Right.
And you need obviously if you only have one pixel per point source, you get very little information.
Okay.
So you
In other words, you can't really map things out if you just if a point source is just a pixel.
Right.
Because
so,
it's...
So you want the light from a point source to basically be spread out over a couple pixels, maybe. So I think our PSF is like 3 pixels wide, is pretty optimal.
And so when they say a point source, what are things that they mean? Do they mean stars?
Stars. Stars okay. are a good point source. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if it's too bright a star, then it bleeds. It saturates things mm-hmm. and things go wonky. But mm-hmm. a dim star should make a point source.
Okay. And so, all right. So you basically the idea is that the
stars are infinitely far away. So
the light from a star will be spread over a few pixels, meaning that it's kind of resolved by a few pixels that image.
Obviously, if you get too many pixels, then you're just wasting. You just need longer exposure times to capture them, and you're just wasting pixels.
I see.
But the thing that's weird about the Rubin Observatory. There are plenty of large telescopes. Mm-hmm. This is an 8.4 meter telescope, so it's not the biggest telescope, but it's in the top 10-ish. Mm-hmm. The thing that's odd about it is it has a very large field of view. Most large telescopes are very small field of view, like 30 arc minutes. They're designed to look at a specific target and expose on it for like half an hour and get a really good image.
Right. So that's like how JWST is
designed
to work.
That's how JWST looks.
You're saying, I want to point it at this one object and just put this long an exposure and then get a really nice image of that one
thing
object, in the sky.
One supernova, one thing.
Yeah.
Rubin is a 9.6 square degree field of view. So it is many times larger than any given other telescope. So in order to capture all the light from all that, we need a really big camera.
I see. So all of that light from all of those different directions within that 10 square degrees. All of that light is coming in, and you need to be able to do something with all of that data and actually resolve it with enough pixels that you're actually
right.
making use of that huge amount, that huge field of view.
Right. So you need a big camera. We need the biggest camera.
Okay, so you were part of the process of building that camera.
Right. So I wore a couple of different hats. When it was being constructed at Slack, I was actually one of the people screwing in the screws and building the camera. Physically building it.
Okay.
So that was when I was a third year, something like that.
Okay.
So I got to do that. That was really cool. You go in the clean room and you build the most expensive Lego set you've ever done. They're assembled in, so each sensor is called a CCD, and each raft that you're assembling is 9 CCDs. And I think we insured the camera for $180 million. So each one of these rafts is a couple million, like $5 million.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So... Yes,
it's a pretty so that must feel scary, at least the first like time going in there.
I wouldn't say it's scary. It's a little awe-inspiring to like actually think about, but when you're actually doing it, you're just doing it.
Okay.
I actually came on to help solve an issue where we had metal filings that we found in the camera, and so one of my jobs was to like go in with a borescope and remove it and do quality assurance testing.
Oh.
So I got to do things like that.
And so these are the sorts of things that like just you that are not planned for.
That was not planned. No.
No, obviously they didn't plan to have iron filings in the camera, but I guess I mean like, yeah, like these are the sorts of things, like these things will come up when right. in any that sort of type of thing will come up, but you didn't the unexpected, like, oh, what are these iron filings doing here?
Yeah, I mean we launched Hubble into space with lenses that didn't work, so
right.
Yeah, that's astigmatism.
So everything else by then.
Everything else is small beans, small potatoes.
So good. So anyway, that was what got you into it. So then, okay, so that was physically building the
structure
camera. Of the camera.
So that wasn't what I signed up for when I went to grad school. But it was a neat thing to be able to do and to say that I did. I got my name on the builder's list because of that.
Oh, nice.
But my main work was at UC Davis. So what we had there was a single CCD from each vendor. There are two different vendors that made CCDs for the camera.
Okay.
And we had a setup with a big lens, a 1-to-1 microscope that mimicked the seeing the beam pattern of the main telescope. Mm-hmm. And we could shine light through a glass plate that only had certain slits or dots illuminated. And so you image what looks like to the camera stars or satellite streaks.
So these are the point sources.
Whatever you want. Point sources will get you point sources.
Whatever you're hoping to emulate.
Well, the most used one was a grid of spots. Okay. So yeah, it was a grid of point sources, and basically you get 40,000 point sources and that data for every image you take.
Okay.
And so we were able to do things like do tests on the CCD of what would happen if we change certain voltages or certain gate voltages or the timing of the readout or...
Okay, and so part of this, you said you had two different vendors who made these CCDs, and part of this was to determine which vendor to go with or what?
So originally that was the plan. Yeah, there were two vendors, ITL mm-hmm. and E2V, who both make CCDs or made CCDs. And the idea was to see which one was the best and then you go with that vendor.
Right.
And it turned out neither one could make the output needed to make all the CCDs for the camera. So the CCD, so that the camera ended up being a collage of both.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so if you look up pictures of the focal plane, you can actually see the difference in color of the E2V versus ITL CCDs because of the quantum efficiency of the light bouncing off of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay, and but probably they're not as that many people as familiar with you about the differences in those.
Yeah, they're both fine. They're both fine, I promise.
But the idea is really road testing these CCDs as much as you can before trying to put them in the camera.
Right. So you test them for a whole bunch of different things. You find, like we talked about, systematic sources of error that crop up, and you try to fix them. So mm-hmm. a lot of these projects, you know, we launch and we open up, we point them at the sky, and that's the first time we see something's wrong.
Right.
You know, you send Hubble up with astigmatism.
Right.
When they first launched JWST, you know, you could see a number of CCD type errors that they later figured out how to resolve.
Right, but they could fix them from the ground.
Right, right. So
they didn't have to go up and like.
No.
but it's a good thing that in that sense they were kind of lucky, right? I mean, if you had a problem that was, you know, that you.
Right. So that is a nice thing about ground-based observatories. If we could have a space, Ruben, that would be nice. But it would be, I mean, that wouldn't be the. Maintenance might not even be the biggest issue if we launched it into space. So.
Well, I guess launching your camera into space might be a little bit difficult.
A little bit difficult.
But
also getting the data back.
Right.
JWST, I'm don't quote me on it, but I think it's of order 100 megabytes, gigabytes mm-hmm. a day that they can download.
You're looking at me as if I know, but but something like that.
We do 20 terabytes a night, 20 to 30 terabytes a night, I believe.
Wow.
And that all that data needs to be taken and transported to the United States the same day.
And so that's non-trivial even from the ground.
Even from the ground. So we have fiber optic cables running from Chile to America that transfer that data.
Wow. Yeah, so that's it's kind of crazy when you get to data that big that how many issues come up that you didn't realize would be real problems that you wouldn't have had to deal with before. So, is there anything specific that you saw in the process of testing these CCDs, like that you discovered that you think that was like issues with the CCDs?
Oh, there's plenty of issues with the CCDs. Some of them we even fixed. one of the my last minute projects that ended up being a big portion of my thesis was finding a way to fix error caused by bright image sources. So you see something like a bright star, and then the way that CCDs collect light is the photon comes in, photoelectric effect happens, they collect electrons. make it as simple as possible.
A photon hits an electron, it frees it from the CCD or from the surface.
In the silicon, yeah.
And then the electron is meant to drive a current.
It's meant to be in these little packets that get read out. And sometimes if you get too much current, not too many electrons in those little packets, they linger somewhere in the silicon and the CCD. And so one of my big projects was figuring out how to change the voltages during the readout, that we were able to eliminate something like 90% of this this error.
Oh.
Obviously, not just me. Like, this is a...
Right.
I work in a large collaboration. The other big thing I worked on was satellites. So a big problem in astronomy in recent times is we have a lot more satellites than we used to, and those are bright sources that cause errors in CCDs.
Even just the past 5 years, we have way, way more satellites than we used to.
Right. So
these things they call like mega constellations or something. Or I don't know if that's the name, but
constellations. Yeah. So 2015 we had about 3,000 satellites. Total, that's GPS, that's everything you use satellites for. This year, I haven't checked in a couple months, but we have over 9,000 satellites. And most of those at this point are constellations like Starlink, which, not to speak ill of Starlink, Starlink is a very useful product, but it does come at some expense of ground-based astronomy.
So when you say it comes at an expense of ground-based astronomy, what do you mean?
Basically, it comes down to that when you take images of the sky, there are going to be streaks in them because these satellites will pass the field of view.
If you put enough satellites in the sky, eventually, basically, every image you take will have a satellite streak in it.
So if you have a target-based telescope, it's not as likely because there's just a small patch of sky you're looking at, and if the satellite goes through, you can just throw out that image, hopefully, unless it's a very long image and then something goes through. For something like the LSST, we have a 10 square degree field of view, so you can't really avoid these satellites.
Right. Every image you take is going to have them.
Every image we take is going to have these satellites in them. If you look at the filings for how many satellites people are planning to launch, it's over a million satellites. That's probably not going to be the actual number, but...
But maybe at someday, some point.
Yeah.
It's growing at a very fast rate.
Right. So right now we're in a situation where people are competing to have constellations, and that's not really...
And from what I understand, the competition is, like, I think a lot of it is just the constellations are trying to do the same thing.
They're trying to provide the same service.
They're all trying to provide the same service, but they're just competing either nations or companies.
Correct. So China has a constellation. Starlink is a constellation. OneWeb.
Mm-hmm.
Kuiper Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company, is trying to have a constellation. So in the near future, we might have a lot of competing satellite constellations.
And so these satellite constellations, do they show up as visible to the naked eye, or are they mostly just sort of thing you would get with really nice telescopes that would hurt your image?
Some of them are going to be visible to the naked eye. One thing Starlink has done is they actually do work with astronomers. Like, they have worked with the Rubin Observatory on ideas of how to make their satellites darker. They're under no obligation to do that.
Right.
So other companies, if they want to compete and outcompete, they might just make them brighter. There's a company that just makes it's called Blue Blue Walker 3 is the satellite. It's by AST Space Mobile. And it is just a 8-meter by 8-meter white satellite that just it's zeroth magnitude.
Wow.
So that's as bright as the brightest stars. So you you will see that. And if that shows up in an LSST image, it will everything will just be white on all the CCDs it touches. So
And you were saying that now, is there basically no regulation of this? Or, I mean, there's sending satellites into space, there's some regulation.
There are regulations by the FFA on, FAA on launching.
Yeah.
There's regulation on radio emissions.
Oh, on how much you can actually emit, but not how much you can reflect.
Reflector.
Or, I don't know.
So on how much radio. On how bright it is in the radio, because people care about radio for communications and things.
Right.
There's currently no regulation on the optical spectrum on how much light they reflect.
I see. So they can be as bright as they want in the optical, and there's no like. There's no laws either in the U.S. or global regulation of any kind.
So it we could have a future where the sky looks like a grid of moving lights.
Well, and the other thing, like you said, it's not just the U.S. because of, like even if you came up with laws in the U.S. to prevent people from launching the space, they could do it in other countries.
So we're currently at a point. So humans can see up to about sixth magnitude scale, anything brighter than that. And that's around where a lot of these satellites are right now.
Right.
There are only about 9,000 stars brighter than sixth magnitude. So there are about 9,000 satellites that are currently up. So currently there are more satellites than stars than you can than see.
Stars that are visible to the naked eye.
Right. So if all of those become
as
bright as zeroth magnitude or even
you would notice
less than that,
it very
you're going to notice it. Notice it very quickly.
Right. So that's not the case at this stage.
It's not the case at this stage, but if you go outside on a dark night, you'll see them. You'll see satellites and constellations.
But it's the sort of thing that you would immediately notice, especially if you live in a city.
Right. Well, you might not see any stars.
You might not see any stars if you live in a big enough city. Yeah. So you worked on sort of figuring out how that was going to affect Ruben, or
right. So that was a big part of our project was we did things like simulate what a satellite streak would looks like through optics and through and onto our CCDs.
Right.
So that was a big part of my thesis and.
And ultimately, though, you can't predict what it will look like in the future because we don't know how many of these there will be and how bright they'll be. You can take a guess. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, you can simulate what a given, you know, a satellite of a given brightness will look like and whether that will be a problem, but you don't know how big of a problem it will be for Ruben unless...
Right. So one thing we can do, though, is we can make suggestions to... for either for regulation or just to the satellite operators of try to make your satellites dimmer than this.
Right.
And Starlink has been fairly cooperative of, okay, well, we should try to make our, because, you know, they don't want to ruin astronomy. They just want to also have their satellite constellation.
Right. But yeah, like you said, no company is required to be that nice about it, and so there's no way to know if somebody decides it'll be cheaper to just launch a really bright one up.
Right.
In terms of how it affects Ruben, now you said it causes. It causes these bright streaks. What do you do about that?
Well, so it depends on how many and how bright. Mm-hmm. So if you have fewer than 10,000 satellites, we can probably avoid, like we can for the most part, just avoid, if we knew where all the satellites were, we could move the telescope to where they're not.
Right.
That becomes not economical. When you get higher than that,
right?
Because basically, by moving the telescope, you lose more data than just taking the image and cutting out the satellite.
Right.
If you get to around 30,000 satellites, which is a number we're almost certainly going to see.
Right.
There's going to be one of these in every image.
Right. No matter what you do.
No matter what you do.
So then you have to have designed some kind of strategies for like truncating images or.
So you have to. You definitely have to have a model for how to automatically find these streaks in an image, mm-hmm. which is doable. But you know it's a thing they're still working out, and you have to. Figure out what errors they cause, what systematics,
right,
and how to reduce those. So, yeah. So because our camera, obviously, so if you have a single sensor, you can read out the data all at one time, and it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want a really big field of view for a camera, you can't just have a larger single sensor because the time it takes to read out the sensor increases with the number of pixels because you read out pixels one at a time with okay. CCDs. So what you do is you segment the camera. So you have multiple CCDs and those all read out at the same time.
Okay, so they're working in parallel.
So
basically.
They're working in parallel. And in Rubin, each CCD is segmented, so it has 16 different readout amplifiers. So 16 different parts of the CCD are all reading out at the same time.
Okay.
So it's highly parallelized. That allows us to read out the entire camera in about 2 seconds.
I see.
If we didn't do that, if it was all one big sensor, it would take hours to read out.
Okay.
Something like 3 to 4 hours, I believe. So
that's just reading the data.
Just reading the
not
data
even
from
that
one
exposure.
Image. And we're taking an exposure every 30 seconds for 10 years. So
so it needs to be better.
So
than
it needs to be 2 seconds, not several hours.
Right.
And so funny things happen when you make segmented CCDs.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's amplifiers in parallel reading things out, you get something called crosstalk.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a bright source in one, you'll have a dim source show up in the next one over.
Oh no!
That's just from electronic crosstalk.
Right.
So each of the readouts acts like a antenna.
Right. Okay.
And it's scaled down by a factor of 10^4, but it's still
if it's
there.
A bright enough, if you get a bright enough streak
enough
in one,
streak,
and you're trying to look for really dim things
right,
in the other.
Right. So we're looking for extremely dim things with the LSSD because we're trying to find things that no one's ever seen before.
Right.
So that becomes an issue. So you need a really good method for scaling this out. Usually crosstalk is a linear effect. But one odd thing we found is that it doesn't behave linearly. So what that means is when you scale, when you make the source image more bright, the response image doesn't get bright
in proportion
to that.
So if you make it twice as bright, the response image isn't quite as bright. If it were, that would be a little bit simpler.
A little bit simpler to model out. So. Basically, what part of my thesis was figuring out why that is, I think we did,
mm-hmm.
which is some minutia about camera readouts
okay.
that nobody cares about. But we also modeled how we should be able to reduce this with as few parameters as possible.
Okay.
So for each segment, you just need a few.
And so I guess what most people probably want to know is what kind of the bottom line is in terms of like, I mean, I guess the rough picture is like, yes, we don't want the satellites to be causing this problem in the first place. But if they are, how bad is the problem? Like, is it the sort of thing that you can, if you get one of these streaks in your images and you have and let's say you do all this modeling to try to remove that noise that it creates, is the data still usable?
So again, it depends on how bright they are.
Right.
So if you have something that's seventh magnitude or dimmer,
yeah,
magnitudes go high numbers,
right.
Dim.
All things in all conventions in astrophysics are backwards and wrong.
Right.
But yes.
Then you're going to be able to map these out, and you're going to be able to subtract the crosstalk with, I think we said like 10% error.
Okay.
Is our high bar.
So it'll leave behind a little bit of error, but you can mostly subtract out.
You can mostly subtract it. If you get to something like fourth magnitude, mm-hmm. which is different than
that's
how,
like
how
the
stars,
magnitude of some stars.
Right. Well, so it's different than stars because stars are stationary in our images versus satellites move.
Right.
So a fourth magnitude satellite will start to saturate the sensor, and so that will basically not be reduced. Well, obviously we're still cutting out the satellite,
right?
But we're going to have more trouble getting rid of the error,
right?
And if you get to something like a zeroth magnitude, like the AST Spacewalker, mm-hmm. that's going to saturate the whole CCD, whole segment.
There's nothing you can do with that data.
So for all of the segments it touches, which on average will be like 12 or 13 CCDs, all of that data is gone. So that's something like 8% of the LSST. So that's, you know, if you're scaling that to how much more time you'd have to take, I think it's something like 10 months. If we have one of those in every image, which we could have more than that, or we could have hopefully fewer.
Right. Okay, so that gives a general sense.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be 8%. But
but it does give us, I mean, it's an important thing to pay attention to because, you know, the next generation of telescope will have to probably deal with an even bigger problem than LSST has to deal with.
Yeah.
So it's something we should be aware of and know, like, how bad of a problem it is and how that scales with the number of satellites. So I wanted to ask you, because you talked about a little bit about stuff that you did. You remembered earlier you said something about you designed a few experiments that saw nothing or something. What did you mean by that?
Well, I've designed a few experiments that should see nothing.
Oh, good.
So a different project I worked on in grad school was looking for dark matter more directly.
Mm-hmm.
It was for a candidate particle called a dark photon.
Right.
Which is basically just it's a dark matter candidate that is weakly coupled to the electromagnetic force.
Mm-hmm.
So
the idea would be that you have some dark matter particle and that it interacts very weakly with our regular matter in a way that it can generate light it's a very weak response, so you wouldn't see it typically.
Right. And so basically you're looking for something that you normally wouldn't pick up,
mm-hmm.
But you are always picking up with a receiver or something.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you get a really good Faraday cage that blocks out all your signal, and you get a really good antenna, you put it inside of the Faraday cage, and you pick up nothing to extremely high precision.
So basically, your Faraday cage just blocks all electromagnetic signals, or as best you can.
Right.
And then you put an antenna inside of that, which is supposed to pick up any electromagnetic signal,
which you do scaled down by however much it is.
However good you're, yeah.
But for a dark photon, it shouldn't scale down by the same factor.
Right, because it's a different, it behaves differently, it doesn't interact with the Faraday cage
as much.
And so you may be able to pick it up with your detector in principle.
So in broad strokes, that's how it works.
Okay.
And we did. We picked up nothing.
We successfully saw nothing. It might have been, so what if you hadn't picked up nothing? In other words, if you had some signal, obviously your first instinct would be, what's wrong with my experiment?
Right. So that's you know, worst case scenario, you actually find dark matter. Right. And then you have to spend the rest of your career saying why that's wrong. So I was not lead on this project, mm-hmm. but I was mm-hmm. one of about three grad students working on mm-hmm. this. Yeah, we actually did pick up a signal at one point, which mm-hmm. was an error, and it had the the number of the pickup was of the frequency that we were picking up was the speed of light in meters per second to like six decimal places.
Okay.
So the first thing we did with that was we went down to the
actual number was whatever 2.9 something times 10 to the 8.
Times 10 to the 8. Yes.
That was the number, and it happened to be the same as the speed of light in meters per second.
I believe so. That was I might be slightly misremembering but so in that case the first thing you do is you go down to the undergraduate lab and you say, is anybody emitting in this frequency,
right?
But yeah, so when everything is working properly, you do pick up nothing. Mm-hmm. and you to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And basically the precision of your experiment gives you a lower bound on what is the coupling between dark matter and the electromagnetic force that could.
Right. So even if you think, you ordinarily might think of it as a disappointment seeing nothing, but the whole point is like, yeah, if you didn't see nothing, then you'd say, what's wrong with my experiment? Right. Right. But then the idea is when you do see nothing, you're still able to say something. You're able to rule out things.
That you carve out a parameter space.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. I was just interested to know because since you talked about that, and you know, everybody's interested in dark matter, so I thought it'd be a neat thing to talk about.
Dark matter is probably not dark photons.
It's probably not dark photons, just based on how much we've ruled out at this point.
Just based on general, there's a lot of candidate particles that seem more promising.
Oh, okay, I see.
Although seem more promising, how should I know? I don't know what it is.
Yeah. I don't have a strong opinion on the matter, but I only know the things I hear about it. I hear about WIMPs and I hear about other things.
I love when people say like, "Oh, it can't be WIMPs. It's got to be axions." And it's like, well, like,
what do you know?
It's an empirical phenomenon.
Right.
We don't actually have a good model for this.
That's right. We would. Yeah. Exactly. It might be something way, way more complicated because who knows? There's no reason for it to be simple.
Right.
Okay. Why don't I ask you? I think we're all basically done. We've talked for a very long time. I've had a great time talking to you, but I can only make the episode so long. So let me ask you this penultimate question. No, this will be the final question, which is, in your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics?
Why should we care about
astrophysics? If you want, you can make this as a pitch to people. Like, if you're talking to a satellite company who's putting a bunch of satellites in space and they go, like, these are really useful, much more useful than your silly astrophysics. Not that they say that, but...
I don't know that I can give you a why, but I can tell you that people do.
Mm-hmm.
I know a bunch of people who had Hubble Space Telescope pictures on their dorm room walls.
Mm-hmm.
I know that... people throughout all human history have seemed to like the stars for one reason or another. whether it's claiming that our when we're born based on the stars is something or another, or just creating calendars, or figuring out what dark matter is. It's something that humans seem drawn to. It's a big part of every culture, the sky. So. I don't know that I can tell you why it's important. I don't know that I can tell you why anything's important, but it seems like people care, and that's a good reason to care about it.
All right. Great. Well, I care too, so thank you so much, Dr. Pollan, for joining me. I had a great time talking science with you, and I hope you'll join me again sometime.
I'm sure I will.
You know, I could spend a whole hour-long episode just complaining about these giant satellite megaconstellations and how they are ruining our ability to do astronomy, but I try my best to stay positive on this podcast and just talk about the amazing discoveries we are able to make every day with incredible observatories like the Rubin Telescope. So thank you so much to Dr. Daniel Pollan for helping us understand just how much work got us to this moment in history. And thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast has been supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG 2206-299. If you want to connect more or have astrophysics questions, feel free to follow us on Blue Sky at paulduffel.bsky.social. The music you hear on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Check out her work if you enjoyed it. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana, by me, Paul Duffel, professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University.